Great. Thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to be here this evening to talk about a topic that's become actually quite hot in Japan, and interestingly so, because in comparison to a lot of other places in the world, the numbers of foreigners are actually still rather small. I'm going to be presenting work, research that I did a few years ago. This is looking at low-paid temporary labor migration programs, or guest work programs, across East Asia. My current research is on something quite different. So while guest work programs typically allow people to come into a country, work and contribute, but then throw a lot of hurdles in terms of becoming citizens, I'm now, in terms of my current research, looking at the opposite: rich people who buy citizenship in countries they've never been to. But nonetheless, these guest work programs are still important and becoming much more popular as well, especially in big policy documents issued by supranational organizations, describing them as triple win situations for the receiving country, for the sending country, and for the migrants themselves. So I think it's very important to really take a close look at how these sorts of programs operate in practice and what are some of the issues around organizing them. The paper I'm going to discuss is situated within this research on migration industries. So Ruben Hernandez León gives a pretty good definition of these as basically the ensemble of entrepreneurs, businesses, and services which, motivated by the pursuit of financial gain, facilitate and sustain international migration. A number of people have worked around the idea of migration infrastructures as well. But in basically what this sort of research looks at are the coyotes, the brokers, remittance services, money lending services, communication services, et cetera, that help connect people between point A and point B. It's basically meso-level, kind of middle-level entrepreneurial activities. And what it's done in terms of the trajectory of migration research is add an economic side to a literature that has traditionally focused on personal networks. So it sort of looks at what are the economics and what is the profit motive doing in connecting people from point A to point B. Now, migration industries themselves can range across a broad spectrum. They can be regulated or unregulated. They can be legal or illegal. They can be formally or informally organized. But the literature to date has largely focused on illegal or irregular activities, trafficking and transportation, for example, in which they see the state as basically creating a supportive or prohibitive context for a migration industry to start. That is, the governments determine what's legal or illegal, and then private actors start organize the flows within this. But basically, the state is seen as creating the playing field rather than being an active participant in the game, in this literature on migration industries. Now, there's two exceptions to this trend in the literature. One is the literature on how destination states have outsourced migration control, things like private sector detention centers, for example, or using G4S to screen visa applicants, et cetera. There's also the literature on sending states, which has often been neglected, but much, much less so in the past 5 years or so. But there's a sizable literature on labor export industries, especially coming out of studies of Southeast Asia, with the Philippines perhaps the most studied example, where the state very famously, since the 1970s or so, has been very much involved in sending labor abroad, first as a way to export unemployment, and now really as a way to try to harness remittances. In this case, though, I want to look at not how just sending states, but also receiving states can actively partner with migration industries to facilitate transnational mobility. Now, if we're going to look at this, the way states partner with private actors, in effect, I want to introduce what I see as a particularly useful orienting device, which is basically a principal-agent relationship. Because the control of cross-border mobility rests within a state sovereign domain, when the states outsource or deputize the other actress to carry out that responsibility, it ends up being a principal-agent relationship. You've got the principal, the state, which has control and rights over this ability of border control, delegating responsibility to an agent, which can be, in this case, either nonprofit or for-profit. Defining a principal-agent relationship is the contract. The contract is what connects them. And the contract can be formal or informal. And, of course, the principal can rescind the contract as well. So if we look at the sorts of relationships we can have the state having a formal contract with a private agent, directly outsourcing responsibility to for-profit enterprises, or formal contract with a nonprofit agent, or they can have an informal, de facto devolving of responsibility to for-profit enterprises or for nonprofit enterprises as well. Now, what's interesting in looking at principal-agent frameworks is that even though the right to control rests with the principal, the agent is carrying that out. And the agent may have different interests from the principal. So, for example, especially in the case of labor migration, the principal, the state, will often have a concern about policing exit, making sure that migrants leave at the end of their contract. Whereas agents, often brokers, are less concerned about making sure people leave. They just want turnover of people so that they continue to make money off the flow of people. Employers, for example, are also tend to be less concerned about exit. They want a worker for as long as they need that worker and as long as the worker is doing a good job. But if the economy or the economic prospects of a company begin to decline, then they want to be able to let go of the worker. But otherwise, they want to continue. So especially in terms of exit, we see a divergence of the different interests of the different actors involved. Now, to look at these sorts of questions of the relationship between these principal-agent relationships, I'm going to consider a couple of guest work programs in East Asia. Guest work programs are useful to look at because they require a close state involvement with the state in order to exist and operate. That is, the state is involved in the entrance point, allowing people in, as well as mobility and maintenance and what's going on while they're on the program. And the third point is exit. So those three different points are important to consider. I'm going to look at cases as well in Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea. These, I think, are interesting comparison cases, too, because they're all more or less democracies. They all have fairly small programs, but in very strong economies. And all of the programs started about the same time in the early 1990s. So they become an interesting point of comparison. So what I'll do with the remaining time is briefly introduce the programs as they were. I did field work about 5 years ago or so. And so there might be some tweaks to the systems since then that I'm less up to date on. But basically, what we have in looking at the Taiwanese system, the government side is going to be pink, and then the for-profit side is coming out in green. In Taiwan, they started off in 1992 with the Employment Services Act. The economy was beginning to take off. They were beginning to shift from military rule to more democratic rule. And basically, they decided to draw on Singapore's system for regulating low-paid temporary workers coming into the country. They have a program where you can have a 3-year visa, but it is renewed up to 4 times. You can end up staying, you know, over 10 years in the country. They have about 500,000 workers evenly split between manufacturing and caretaking, with men coming from Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam, and women often coming from Indonesia and the Philippines. The system is run by the Ministry of Labor, which for many years was known as the Council of Labor Affairs, which basically sets the parameters of the program, assesses labor market needs, et cetera. But the real implementation, the actual interaction with the migrants themselves, is carried out by a field of licensed brokers. So there are over 1,000 broker firms dominated by about 20 very large ones and then going down to very small ones and down to sort of gray area and people, you know, guys with a cell phone, that sort of thing as well. These brokers get a two-year permit from the government in order to run the program. And basically what happens is employers will apply for the right to hire a migrant worker, a job order, and there's competition for these, and then brokers will pay them for the ability to fill that slot of work, basically by extracting fees from the migrants themselves. The brokers will collect the individuals from the airport. Sometimes the brokers will have company ties to brokers in sending countries as well. The brokers also take care of the ongoing paperwork, the medical checks, the visa renewals, again, charging migrants for these services, often overcharging them as well. And they're also in charge of exit. Now, the government polices this very strictly by requiring the brokers to leave a deposit with the government that is returned only when the migrant leaves for his or her home country and the broker returns with the departure slip to the government. So they go to great lengths to actually ensure that participants don't leave the program for the to work irregularly within the country as well. Of course, this the numbers of people who leave these programs who become irregular workers are always very difficult to assess, but the numbers in Taiwan indicate that they probably are fairly low. Even though now in the past few years they've reformed the program so that employers can hire migrants directly, they still almost always go through brokers because it's easier for them to handle the paperwork. And what we've seen with this program is a steady expansion over time, with the numbers doubling over the past 10, 15 years. And what's interesting as well, they use a strong kind of language of market and using competition to control the market. And they use that even when they're instituting reforms. So the government, for a while, there were complaints that many brokers and employers were violating the law. So the government developed a market exit system where the brokers would be ranked A, B, or C, and those who got C 2 years in a row would be kicked out, et cetera. Of course, very few were, only about 1% were. But what we see in general, the Taiwanese system is a very strong example of a privately managed system based on profit and loss, where the state uses competition and market mechanisms to keep the agents in line with the state's own interest. And the state basically claims that this is the most efficient way to do it, and it saves resources for the country. In Japan, I won't go into too many details because I think Professor Naota will speak about, or Professor Higuchi will speak about this as well, and this sort of system has come out in the paper quite a lot recently. What we have, though, is the TITP, which started in 1991, was reformed in 1993, basically through bureaucratic adjustments of older internship programs dating from the 1950s, even. Used to be 3 work permits. Now these have been extended to 5. There's more than 150,000 participants right now. There's 330,000, which is sizable. It's about 20% of the foreign workforce in Japan. A lot are coming from China, though also from Southeast Asia, and we see them in manufacturing, textiles, food processing, and metalwork. Now, this whole system is overseen by JITCO, which is kind of a quasi-governmental organization under 5 ministries. But what it basically does is operate as a service provider for implementing organizations, which are employers, and supervising organizations, which in many, many cases, about 80% of them are brokers. The reason why the government uses this sort of language is because Japan very famously, until recently, was even reluctant to suggest the notion that low-paid temporary migrant workers could actually come into the country. And instead, the system was presented as a form of training and education, like study abroad and skills transfer for migrant workers. And, you know, they would liken it to, the study abroad programs and, you know, where you can, you know, refine your skills in gutting fish. or pouring cement, which, you know, really, it takes 3 years to write a PhD. It does not take 3 years to learn how to gut a fish. So anyways, what we have in the end in Japan, basically, is so what we see in this, brokers take care of the migrants in almost all these stages under the guise of these implementing organizations. Taking over oversight, meeting migrants at the airport, taking over oversight where necessary, as well as overseeing exit. But because the system has these disrupted chains of responsibility through these informal contracts, what we see is, for the government, a very convenient corporate veil. It all looks very nice on paper, but in practice, what is going on is quite different. There have been a lot of accusations of abuse. The UNHCR has likened it to slavery and forced labor. Japan was on a tier two status for trafficking under the program as well through all of this. So in a sense, you have these broken chains of responsibility through these informal relationships that also, to some degree, make expansion difficult. To the extent that the program is growing, the government comes under more pressure to clean it up and make sure that it operates in a much more formal and legitimate way. South Korea, interestingly, started off, you know, a lot of South Korea's policies have traditionally started off looking at Japan and then going beyond them. South Korea started off with the ITP, like Japan's TITP, but instead of JITCO, had KITCO, which was aligned with the Korean Federation of Small Businesses very closely. They also had delegation control agencies, which were basically brokers, and 20 of them, that took care of managing the program. However, as South Korea very famously from the night, you know, in the past, but also through the 1990s and 2000s, has had a very lively kind of civic action, public protest movements. And there were quite a lot of civil society uproar around abuses around the program. Then in 1993, Roh Moo-hyun was elected president, a former human rights lawyer who wanted to get a Nobel Prize in peace. And one of his flagship programs was reforming the guest work program into what became the EPS, the Employment Permit System, in 2004. Now, the whole rhetoric around this was the idea of cutting brokers' ties, taking it out of the private sector and into the nonprofit sector in order to reduce the amount of debt that migrant workers were going into. What's interesting here is that they looked to Germany as a model. Here we are at the DIJ. But not as Germany is usually considered with guest work programs. Now, very often people talk about Germany as a failed model of guest work programs, even though the majority of Turkish and Italian or whatever workers going to Germany in the 50s, 60s, and 70s eventually left. The majority did leave. But South Korea, and now there's been increasing research on this, but still it's only just a small bit, was sending nurses to Germany to work in the 50s, really the 60s and 70s. And so the government officials, aware of that, looked at how that program is run to get ideas. And through that developed the EPS system. Now there's about 250,000 people on the program. You work for 3 years, but you can take it up to 4 years and 10 months, basically because after 5 years, you can apply for a permanent residence. So they're making sure that you still can't apply for permanent residence. But the idea was to move all of this within the auspices of the government, initially under Human Resources Development Korea, a government agency, which was understaffed. And so it began to link with the business federations and with NGOs, basically nonprofit, non-associative actors for organizing the program. So now about 40 NGOs get government funds to support the legal, medical, and linguistic needs of migrant workers, limiting private sector involvement. What's interesting here, too, is that so we see Korea, in a sense, moving from these informal contracts with private agents to a more formal contract with nonprofit agents to run the program. What's interesting, too, is that the number of people leaving the program to work irregularly, the number of quote-unquote runaways, has dropped significantly from about 50% to around 20%. And the amount of debt that migrants take on in going to these countries has dropped as well, from about $3,500 to about $2,800. And it's interesting, too, there have been changes within this and some rollbacks of the extent of the rights of migrant workers in the system. But what's interesting is that even the rollbacks are still within an anti-broker, anti-market rhetoric. So employers were complaining, for example, that migrant workers could change employers too easily. If they didn't like their place of work, they could, you know, go to an NGO, get a list of other employers who can hire migrant workers, and change their employer pretty easily. Employers don't like that. If they want a worker as long as they're good, and they want to let them go if business is doing bad. And so employers complained that not migrant workers, but their brokers were taking them to these offices and helping them change jobs, which in the interviews I did sounded like it wasn't really the case. But in order to push for change, they still kept that anti-broker rhetoric, which I found quite striking. The final program I'll mention very quickly is the Visit and Employment Program, which is largely targeted at co-ethnic Chinese Koreans. There's about 300,000 people on the program. They can work in about 32 jobs at a slightly higher level than the people on the EPS. This is run by, interestingly, the Ministry of Justice and not the Ministry of Labor. And, you know, it's just an opportunity to come to the country. And what people can end up doing is going to the national job centers that are available for Korean nationals and get jobs through that. So in a sense, we have an informal relationship with a nonprofit agent, actually government organizations in terms of the way the programs operate. So if we look at the way these fall out in terms of principal-agent relationships, we've got the Taiwan's managed, privately managed system, a formal contract using market mechanisms, very strictly run, and you know, lots of complaints about abuse, but with very high exit numbers. It's similar to Singapore. Singapore also has this. The GCC countries like the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, et cetera, tend to have those as well. In Japan, we have a private agent with an informal contract, kind of an unofficial collaboration with brokers who are really the ones running the programs, like what we used to have in Korea in the 90s, as well as the flying visa process, which we find in the Middle East as well. Formal contracts and nonprofit agents, we have publicly discharged programs like the EPS in South Korea, but that was also the case in South Africa with the labor migration program run by TEBA, which is privatized in 2005. So TEBA eventually moves over to a formal contract. The U.S. Bracero program looked like a nonprofit agent as well. And then also pretty rare, they're hard to find examples, but these publicly overseen programs like Korea's VEP, you could, you know, also look at, say, New Zealand's Working Holiday Maker program as an example of one of those as well. So I offer this as a way to look at how these different principal-agent relationships affect the organization of migrant worker programs based on degree of formality and informality, whether formal programs make direct intervention easier should problems arise. Informal programs, we have a lot of light-touch government intervention with workarounds. Or for-profit, in which case the government tends to have greater delegation of responsibilities, and we see the programs expanding over time as for-profit actors try to get more profit. Or nonprofit, where we see greater state control, the state maintaining, delegating, in effect, much less of the control of these systems as well. So I'm introducing this as a way to maybe think about Japan within context, both in terms of the way its low-paid temporary worker programs are operating now and the way they're changing in the future. So I'll stop there and turn it over to Professor Higuchi.
Today I'd like to talk about recent changes in the immigration policy in Japan, especially focusing on a comparison between Nikkei Japanese descendants under new visa category for specified skilled workers. I think most of the people coming here know about the overview of the new Immigration Act, but I will explain first because there are two kind of visa categories, skilled worker 1 and 2. And 1 is extension of technical interns, which is notorious to as a hotbed of labor exploitation. But it opens the front door to import unskilled workers, although the government officially keeps a policy not to admit unskilled workers, because the government still asserts that they are not unskilled workers. So they did not change the policy. But what is new, especially new in terms of status of migrants, is the skilled worker too, because it prepared the path to permanent settlement for blue collar workers, and workers too can invite their families. So this is actually a permanent migrant. But what I would like to say is that the government learned much from experiences to admit Nikkei instead of technical interns. Because behind the scene of the new immigration policy, there is a new migration regime for Nikkei. Because the government prepared a new visa for the fourth generation Japanese descent last year. Until then, the fourth generation of Japanese descendants could live in only as dependent families of the third generation. So if they are adult or if they are married, they cannot enter Japan as Nikkeijin. Nikkeijin means Japanese descendants. But the government prepared a visa for fourth generation, ages between 18 to 30. But this means not new preparation for visa categories, but this is virtually crossing the side door to import ethnic migrant workers. It's my interpretation to the new policy. Because there are two categories of side door workers in Japan. One is Japanese descendants who are officially regarded as families of Japanese to visit Japan, and then they are allowed to work. And the other is technical interns who are working in Japan for technical transfers to developed countries. But there we can find the convergence of the two, because the fourth generations are allowed 5-year stay, which is not renewable. So they can live in Japan on the maximum of 5 years, unless they married to a Japanese or others with legitimate visas. And they required the Japanese test N4 level, although they are allowed to engage in any jobs with other Nikkei, but they are not allowed to live permanently in Japan. And unlike the Nikkei up to third generation, they are requested to pass the Japanese test. It is more similar to specified skilled worker 1, because although they have to work in specified jobs, only they are allowed to work in specific industries of 14 industries with labor shortage, but they can live 5 years, and which is upgradable to skilled worker too, and they are thought to be upgraded from interns. This means that government evaluation is admission of Nikkeijin is a failure and in turn a success. So my question today is that what has changed under the new immigration regime and why? So first I will change, I will trace the changes in the 1919 migration regime to 2019 migration regime. And I will evaluate the problem of the new migration policy, feasibility of the neoliberal meritocracy, and the need for more proactive policies. And usually, the admission of Nikkeijin is sought to solve the labor shortages during the economic boom around 1990. But the beginning of the preparation of visa is quite different. They are based on the idea of nationalism because the Ministry of Justice began to consider a visa equivalent to third generation Koreans for third generation Nikkeijin. This is quite before the economic boom because it was based on the Japan-Korea bilateral negotiation in 1985. And the visa for third generation Nikkeijin was prepared in 1989 and enforced in 1990. So it is more precise to understand that the demand for Nikkeijin workers was combined with the principle of jus sanguinis. And the technical intern started in 1993, but before there has been training systems existed since the 1960s, but the nature had greatly changed in 1990s. This is the main feature of the 1990 immigration law prepared a visa for third generation Nikkeijin, but during the period after the economic bubble, it has happened to come down with Nikkeijin. The number of Nikkeijin steadily increased after the collapse of the economic bubble until 2008. But the task force of Ministry of Justice regarded Nikkeijin migration as a failed policy. And meanwhile, technical interns are extended to work up to 3 years compared with the 1 year program before. And they have been, more or less segregated in the labor market because Nikkeijin used to work in export industries such as car and electronics industry, but mostly interns worked in more labor intensive industry like textile garments or agriculture or fisheries. But then the Deputy Minister of Justice and now Defense Minister Taro Kono said in 2006, it is a failure to accept Nikkeijin. Japan lacked integration policies. This is based on the reality that lack of mobility from agency workers. At first, Nikkeijin was most privileged among the newcomers because they enjoyed a stable visa status and unlimitable choice of jobs. But most of them were incorporated into agency workers or haken rodosha. And the situation did not change even after a decade or so. Most of the workers are still working in as agency workers. This is quite contrary to common sense of migration research because most migrants started from the bottom of the labor market, but they go up the ladder of the labor market, learning skills or learning language. But in the case of Nikkeijin, such kind of social mobility did not occur. So the policies of Japanese government are getting more unsympathetic to Nikkei. So especially after the Lehman shock, because majority of Nikkei lost jobs during the Lehman shock, and the government introduced a notorious pay-to-go policy, which paid about 300,000 yen for those lost jobs and go home. But at the same time, the government prepared, launched a department for integration with Nikkei in 2010, and prepared a language course, and launched a five-year project for education of children. So they prepared some kind of forced repatriation and integration. But at the same time, what happened in Japan is the expansion of technical interns. It has changed the system in 2010. The one-year training period was replaced by the longer intern system. And the government insisted on the technical interns, even though there are repeated criticism by U.S. government, Department of State, which criticized Japan as promoting a policy for trafficking. So then the government enacted a Technical Intern Training Act, which extended the period of technical interns from 3 to 5 years. So this is a kind of contrasting policies, and the result is also clear. At first, there has been more Brazilians in 2007, but the number of interns were surpassed the number of Nikkei. And because of the lack of mobility and because of the getting tired of unstable jobs, the number of Latin Americans have decreased by 40 to 20%. Although the number is a little recovering because of the recession of Brazil. So what we should understand from the changes is that from blood ties to meritocracy. So because Japan used to be a more willing host of Nikkei, but for first generation Nikkei, Japan turned out to be a reluctant host. They required language skills and non-renewable, and family unification is not allowed. So although the government estimated the maximum quota for first generation for 4,000 a year, but actually only 43 persons acquired a visa, and only 33 persons entered Japan. It is so demanding to clear the criteria. I also become one of them as a supporter, and I rented money of about 100,000 yen for paperwork, and it took three months. He's working now in Japan, but it took too much from him. And on the other hand, the government paved the way for permanent settlement to specified skilled workers 1 and 2. They are able to change jobs within the same industry. And family unification is allowed for skilled 2. And able to apply for permanent residence after 5 year jobs as skilled workers. It is a long way because most of they work 5 years for technical interns, and then more 5 years as skilled worker one, and then after 10 years, they are allowed to become a skilled worker two. So it is too long to take a more stable status. But the government paid the way for permanent settlement. Specific skilled workers are allowed to live in Japan for longer times, but they have to survive neoliberal meritocracy. In this context, neoliberal means that they have to manage on their own. So they are not provided opportunities to learn Japanese course for jobs. There are simply Japanese courses for everyday conversation, only once or twice a week for 2 hours, which is not useful for acquiring Japanese skills used for jobs. This is a governmental policy, but those acquired language skills on their own can climb up the ladder to specific skilled worker too. And technical interns are sought to learn Japanese equivalent to the N4 level, and they can nearly automatically change a job, change a visa to specific skilled workers. And after 5 years, they are also change a visa to specific skilled worker too, but the requirement is imposed is not so clear now, but they have to survive for 5 years, and at last they can gain the more stable status. But I would like to emphasize that language matters. This is data based on my fieldwork in Argentina and Japan. This means that the Japanese skills, the relation between Japanese skills and the jobs gained. This means that full-time or self-employment or regular work are not accessible for those who use Japanese only everyday conversation or below or less. For those who have good command or fluent in Japanese can have a chance to get more stable jobs. And recruitment network is more important because if you find jobs through migrant network or family network, most of the work are agency works or part-time. Full-time or self-employed is below 10%. But if you use impersonal methods such as a media or a hard work, the rate will jump up. But if you find job through Japanese, the accessibility to full-time or self-employed jobs is much higher. Nearly 40% can gain regular work or self-employment because of the advantage of Japanese to access to labor market. But if you get contact with Japanese, you have to have a command of Japanese. So the command of Japanese is the minimum requirement to get stable jobs or for social mobility. But actually, most of the jobs are gained through migrant or family networks, which is useful to get, migrant jobs with unstable or no promotion. But there are only small people who get jobs through Japanese. So it's necessary to provide chance to, for example, to gain language skills. But the government is demanding too much and serving too little. When I conducted fieldwork during Lehman shock, this is the most important lesson, because those who have the command of Japanese could change jobs even during the recession. So needed a language course which is efficient to use in the business scene. But the government established a very modest language program with limited effect, which is which start from 120 or 180 hours. But for example, in Germany, it is expected to learn 600 hours, which is much longer than the Japanese case. And I would like to tell the Japanese government that there are pitfalls of the cheap way, because the government bears the burden of learning Japanese on their own. The migrants bear their burden of learning Japanese on their own during while they work hard. It is very difficult, actually, because most of the Nikkei, almost 80% of the Nikkei, do not speak Japanese fluently, because they work too long to earn as much as possible. So as a result, there is little productivity gains after 5 or 10 years. And it is also it will also bring about a failed growth strategy, because the stagnation of productivity do not bring out economic growth the government expected. So there's a need to at least provide intensive language courses for new policies. Thank you.